Today on Against the Grain.
Fascism is not a form of conservatism, and it's not just another element of the right, it's a radical extreme right-wing form that actually doesn't even like conservatism or reactionaries, but it can use them. It's extremely anti-leftist and anti-liberal, but it can use conservatives.
The global rise of the authoritarian right has confounded classification and led to contentious debates on the left. Do politicians like Modi, Bolsonaro, Orban, and Trump represent an extreme form of right-wing populism? Or are they fascists, as some claim? Historian and scholar of populism and fascism, Federico Finkelstein, argues that we're seeing something new, a phenomenon that blurs the lines between the two. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When we look at the history of the far right globally, we can see different eras and distinct forms. The early half of the 20th century was dominated by fascism, which ultimately ended in military defeat. And in the latter half of the 20th century, discredited fascists lurked in the shadows while right-wing populists distance themselves from fascism. But in the 21st century, far-right politicians have come to power electorally who seek to dismantle democracy, while so far not having imposed one of the hallmarks of fascism, dictatorship. To make sense of what we're witnessing today, I'm joined by Federico Finkelstein. He grew up in Argentina during the military rule of the Dirty War and is an expert on populism, fascism, and dictatorship. Finkelstein is in exile research professor of history at the New School for Social Research in New York, and the author most recently of The Wannabe Fascists, A Guide to Understanding the Greatest Threat to Democracy. His other books include A Brief History of Fascist Lies and From Fascism to Populism in History, which we interviewed him about previously on Against the Grain. Federico, I wonder if you could begin by defining for us right-wing populism on the one hand and fascism on the other as a starting point for our discussion. What characterizes each of these?
Yes, well, fascism and populism are forms of authoritarianism, but one populism sticks with democracy and works within democracy to downplay actually democracy and to bastardize it, denigrate it, but never end it. And on the other hand, there is fascism, which is an authoritarian right-wing ideology that always wants to destroy democracy to create a dictatorship.
You're a historian, and you argue that we can't understand these things you've just spoken of, right-wing populism and fascism, without situating them historically as well as globally. How should we broadly understand the rise and fall of fascism and populism in the 20th century and into the 21st?
Yes, well, populism existed before fascism, but it never achieved power. And, after the First World War, fascism emerges as an authoritarian form that takes from populism many things, including, messianic views, apocalyptic understandings of the past, the present, and the future, and turns it into something different, which is a way to destroy democracy from within in order to create a dictatorship from the top. And in that regard, fascism, it's a newism that represents or wants to represent a sort of third way, an option number three between capitalism and socialism. And it does so from a right-wing nationalist perspective. Now, after 1945, as you know, fascism is defeated. I mean, the most important leaders of fascism, Hitler in Germany, Benito Mussolini in Italy, they are defeated. And what was then before a tripolar war becomes a bipolar war, like the Cold War, in which, you know, there were only two predominant options. But after that, some people that used to be fascists or were fellow travelers of fascism or dictators that wanted to represent that option number three between communism and capitalism, they kind of reformulated into a democratic form of authoritarianism, which is populism. And as opposed to the populists of the past, these new populists that used to be fascist, they reach power. And they do so first in Latin America with people like Juan Domingo Perón in Argentina or Getúlio Vargas in Brazil. And eventually, I mean, this form of authoritarian politics within democracy, it will become important in other places, including Asia, Africa, Europe, and yes, also the U.S.
So how do you see the rise of extreme authoritarianism in our period, in the 21st century, especially in the last decade and a half? How would you characterize it? Can it be characterized in a universal way?
Yes, I mean, these are, I mean, the key questions of our time, I think, which is, what is going on? Why forms of politics which used to be democratic, that is to say populist, I mean, obviously a combination of authoritarianism and democracy, but always within democracy, why these forms are becoming so close to what used to be fascism? I mean, so are we witnessing a turning point now in which people that, you know, that were supposedly, elected leaders working within democracy are trying so much to destroy key elements of democracy, such as the separation of powers, the rule of law, and so on and so forth, the independence of the press, the right not to be arrested because you speak in a certain way or the color of your skin, things that, you know, which used to be way more connected to a previous time. So basically, let me go back to that previous time and in order to establish the continuities and the distinctions. In fact, what happened after 1945 is that populists rejected what I call in my recent book, The Wannabe Fascist, the four pillars of fascism. I mean, key elements of fascism that without them you don't have fascism. And these elements were, number one, violence and the militarization of politics. This fascist idea that violence is the source of power, but you are powerful when you unleash that violence. And in that sense, fascism broke with other traditions that always took violence as a means, right? The idea that violence is, can work in order to establish a legitimacy, but somehow, if there was a continuum of violence, that meant a political weakness. So fascists sought the opposite. They thought that by being violent towards others, they were more powerful. And that, along with that, another idea came, an outcome of that, was the idea of politics as war. I mean, the lack of distinctions between actual war and internal politics. And this is the militarization of politics, which in practice led to the formation of paramilitary groups and militias, people, you know, men with guns glorifying violence and taking violence onto others. And in fact, they were not soldiers. They were playing to be soldiers and their guns, you know, were not like supposed to be part of the political process. And yet it was, they were. So that's element number one. So fascists before 45, this element was central to them. After 45, for populists, not so much. Like they regarded this as a problem to win elections. The second element is fascist lies and totalitarian propaganda. Fascists lied way more than other politicians. Generally, in politics, you know, lies are part of the picture in all political traditions, in the sense that politicians promise things that they cannot do or they will not be able to do, and they know that, so they are often lying to us. But the difference is that the fascists, they believe their lies. Not only they lie more, but also they believe their lies, and they are not only restricted to that, but rather to the idea that it is important for reality to look like the lies they tell, and thereby they need to change reality in order for reality to be like the lies. I always mention this radical example of this, which is what the Nazis did with one of the most awful Nazi lies that said that Jews were dirty and spread disease. So basically, obviously, that is a horrible lie. But the Nazis put their Jewish victims in ghettos and concentration camps with horrible sanitary conditions, and eventually these victims became dirty and they became ill and they even spread disease. But of course, this was a laboratory in order to change reality, in order for reality to be like the lie. It was not true that they were that, but they turned them into personifications of the lie. Now, more recently, we can see a similar procedure with the idea that, you know, a president in the U.S. can be elected for a third term, for, you know, term number three. And you know, to the extent, I mean, and that is a lie, but eventually we might see that some people are trying to make that lie a possibility. So element number three is the politics of xenophobia. Extreme demonization and extreme dehumanization. Of course, you can have this in other ideologies and in other regimes, but this is key to fascism. The idea that hatred should be put at the center of politics. That is not toxic at all, but actually it should be at the center of politics. And last but not least, element number four is dictatorship. The idea that democracy eventually has to be destroyed in order to create a dictatorship. So populists after 1945 left these four elements behind. They left violence, fascist lies and propaganda, and the politics of demonization and dictatorship behind in order to engage in an authoritarian way, yes, but to engage with democracy. And what we are seeing in our century, in the 21st century, is that populist politicians of the right wing that seem to be returning to these four elements of fascism. Of course, none of them is as extreme as it was in fascism, but also this is not typical of populism either. This is a new phenomenon in which I call the wannabe fascists, people that are incomplete fascists, that they would like to be as close to fascism as they possibly can.
Well, let me ask you about another aspect of fascism, which you mentioned earlier, which is that fascists saw fascism as a third way. So, you know, socialism on the one side, capitalism on the other, and then fascism. And I wanted to ask you how you think that the elites or the politicians who are driving the right-wing authoritarianism of our time regard capitalism.
Fascism was and is an ideology of the extreme right. Economically, it always stood and stands by the status quo. Of course, fascism is not an instrument of this interest, but rather plays along with them. And, you know, and actually fascists talk about the primacy of politics, so politics being always more important than economics. But to the extent that, you know, they care about economics, they always side on the side of capitalism. So basically, when we hear these arguments that fascism is an ideology of the left, I have to be clear about this. There is no single serious scholar of fascism that says this, and this is just another lie, a fascist lie, a propaganda lie. So fascism is always against, you know, is for a hierarchical society, both culturally, politically, and economically, and is always against egalitarian, you know, measures and a more plural society. That is at the center of fascism.
So you were talking about thinking historically about fascism, how right-wing populism existed before fascism, but then in the first half of the 20th century was the fascist era. And that 1945, the military defeat of fascism, transformed the form that the far right took, and that then we saw other forms of right-wing authoritarianism. When you look at the trajectory of the right historically, these different eras, what would you say drives that right-wing authoritarian impulse? I'm meaning from the top, I'm not really asking about those mass supporters, but from the top, Is that an impulse that's just always lurking there? Or would you say that those who embrace it do so under particular situations? Does it actually take cycles, and could we understand what those cycles consist of?
Fascism is not a form of conservatism, and it's not just another element of the right. It's a radical extreme right-wing form that actually doesn't even like conservatism or reactionaries, but it can use them. It's extremely anti-leftist and anti-liberal, but it can use conservatives. Ironically, conservatives historically, they often think that they can control these fascists, and in many cases they fail. So they contributed to normalize them, and eventually they were all also minimized or even persecuted. So there is, you know, I don't think fascism, it's a natural or even a consequence or even logical that the conservatives should ally themselves with the fascists. They often do, but always that leads to, you know, to problems for them as well.
So are there particular circumstances in which conservatives then might be more tolerant of fascism, given that fascism could transform things that are valuable to them? Can one generalize historically at what kind of conjunctures historically that conservative elites might turn toward fascism?
Well, historically, you know, we have seen, many times, for example, with Hitler and Mussolini, but also with others, that when conservatives, you know, ally themselves with the fascists and with the extremists, they did so, as I said, with the idea of controlling them. They couldn't, and this is not, you know, the fascist movements are not conservative movements, and they want to turn the world upside down. Something that, of course, conservatives do not want. So basically, it's not really the case that they can function organically as they often think that would be the case.
I'm speaking with historian Federico Finkelstein. He is the author of The Wannabe Fascists, A Guide to Understanding the Greatest Threat to Democracy. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So for a number of years, there have been debates on the left about whether Trump is or isn't a fascist. So speaking now of the United States, in The Wannabe Fascist, you argue in a way against both sides of that debate. One side holds that Trump represents an extreme form of right-wing populism, and the other argues that Trump is an out-and-out fascist. Why do you feel like neither assessment gets it right?
I mean, let's, for example, talk about those that say that there is no connection whatsoever between Trump and fascism. They tend to, A, not be experts in the field of fascist studies, and B, they tend to somehow believe that when there are continuities in history or connections in history, those connections need to be almost an equation, in the sense that, you know, in order for someone like Trump to be fascist, like his experiences and policies should be, you know, almost the same as Hitler's policies. And there is no such thing in history. I mean, the past is the past and the present is the present. And if the litmus test for this debate is that whether Trump looks like Hitler or wears the same mustache, obviously that will not be the case. And I think, you know, at some point that part of the debate, that angle becomes extremely simplistic. And now when you start to ask the question more seriously, more historically, in the way of saying, okay, fascism has been this and that, and then what are we seeing in the present that connects to that? And by the way, often those connections are explicit in terms of admiration or even glorification of past racist and fascist, you know, cases, in which you see these wannabe fascists actually liking what they saw, what they see in the fascist past. And yet that doesn't mean that they could be, you know, totally identified that, because, I mean, in terms of these four pillars of fascism, violence, a militarization of politics, the demonization of the other, via racism and xenophobia, these totalitarian lies and dictatorship. In all these pillars, wannabe fascists like Trump are not as radical or extreme as the fascists were. And yet they are not typical populists. So the point is, in my own answer to the question of whether Trump is a fascist or not, involves a yes and a no. I mean, he's flying very close to fascism, but he's an incomplete, as I argue in the book, he's an incomplete fascist, a fascist that a person that wants to, that aspires to a sort of, fascist regime and fascist form of leadership, and for a variety of reasons, including sometimes an stress or an emphasis on personal gain, sometimes a lack of ideological, coherence, and other personal, limitations, cannot become what at some other points would like to be, which is a fascist leader. So he's a wannabe fascist.
Why do you fear, generally, that what we're seeing now may alight into fascism? Because just going back to the way that the debate that I mentioned on the left was framed between right-wing populism on one hand, kind of extreme forms of right-wing populism, and then fascism on the other. But you write about the possibility that right-wing authoritarianism may allied into fascism. Are there historical examples that you can point to where this has happened in the past, and why do you fear that now?
The question is, often is who is asking the question, right? Because on the other side, like this idea that this cannot be fascist because the policies we are seeing happened before. And then again, I wonder who is asking this question, because depending on where these people are, in our society now, where they are persecuted or not, where they are feeling a difference between Trumpism and the past, then, the answer to the question is, can be different. For example, in the case of fascism, as I explain in the book, during the interwar years, different African-American intellectuals were saying, what we are seeing in Europe is what we have been seeing in the U.S. And in fact, like, for example, the historian Robert Paxton said that the first fascist organization in the world was the KKK. So the point is, like, sometimes it's very difficult to, hard to understand why people will emphasize that there is no any connection with fascism in the U.S., because the U.S. has a rich history of fascism and racism.
Sure, but at the same time, that history of fascism and racism hasn't engulfed the entire society. So I guess the question is, what are the stakes in getting the analysis correct? Are there different implications in terms of the kind of organizing that people might do, given one kind of set of analysis or another? It does seem that there's great fear within the society, including on the left, about what is happening. Would you say that it is important for us to really drill down and understand it?
Well, yes. And in fact, I think that the question of understanding or thinking that this is somehow connected to fascism and there is a clear fascist danger, in the past had led people that were against fascism, that is to say anti-fascist, that they sided on the side of constitutional democracy, to put their difference aside and be part of a kind of big universe of people that stood on the side of democracy. So if there is a fascist danger in the past, different people from center, left, and even right, and even some conservatives, that was not the time to be sectarian, and it was the time to defend democracy.
Federico Finkelstein is my guest. He's University in Exile Research Professor of History at the New School in New York, scholar of populism, fascism, and dictatorship, and the author most recently of The Wannabe Fascists, A Guide to Understanding the Greatest Threat to Democracy. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I wanted to ask you, we'll return to the United States, but speaking more globally, and you and your work argue that often the analysis of fascism and right-wing populism tends to be Eurocentric, to the harm of really understanding the dynamics at play. Narendra Modi in India, Viktor Orban in Hungary, and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil have employed three of the four categories that you had mentioned earlier. So you were saying that the kind of hallmarks of fascism are extreme xenophobia, the use of lies and very extreme propaganda, and political violence, but not dictatorship. And so all of those regimes in India, in Hungary, in Brazil have been defined by the use of those, but they did not end up in dictatorships, or at least not successfully. When you look at what is happening in the United States and the degree to which it's following a playbook from those other countries, what parallels and dissimilarities do you see between, say, the United States and a country like Hungary?
I think the U.S. is going in a more extreme direction. And I think the best comparison will be with Brazil, because in you know, the so-called Trump of the tropics, Bolsonaro, a mini Trump of sorts, a person that deeply admired Trump to the extent that after, you know, January 6, which was at least also an important turning point for my hypothesis about how this is close to fascism, because in the U.S. what we witnessed in January 6 was a coup d'etat, a failed coup d'etat, but a coup d'etat. And 1 year later, Bolsonaro attempted the same in Brazil when he himself lost the elections. And his attempt, as a Trump attempt, failed. But the key difference is that in Brazil, after that, Bolsonaro was put on trial and he was convicted for his crimes. And so basically a question that was not only related to history, because what happened was that there was a coup d'etat, not really like a happy time and not really a peaceful time, as we could hear from both, you know, Trumpist and Bolsonarista sources regarding their, you know, their events to nullify the elections they lost. What happened in Brazil is that that was, you know, that history was not only recognized as a fact, as a history, but also connected to the rule of law. And thereby, you know, Bolsonaro cannot be a candidate in the same way that Trump was in the U.S. because, like, he was, you know, he had to face the law. Now, as you know, that didn't happen in the U.S. and a person that shouldn't have been a candidate was a candidate and won. So whenever, I mean, this is typical of this was typical of fascists, but also typical of wannabe fascists, is that whenever elections work for them, they are okay. Whenever they don't work for them, they deny them, they abuse the historical record in order to create mythical realities and fantasies, and even they attempt, in a typical fascist way, to change reality in order for reality to be like the, you know, the lies they tell. So supposedly, if the elections were not a defeat, but actually something that they won, they were entitled, according to this fantasy, they were legitimate in their anti-democratic, anti-constitutional attempts. Now, all these fantasies, which are extremely anti-democratic and anti-constitutional, and they included coups d'etat, failed coup d'etat, I mean, they met different fates in Brazil and the US. And I think the consequences are clear for both countries. The US is a country that has not dealt with this in terms of connecting what happened with the rule of law.
And we'll return to that in a moment, but I wanted to ask you, bearing in mind that you're saying that the U.S. may be in a category of its own, but if you look at the rule of Orban in Hungary or Modi in India, while they have incited violence and done great damage to democracy in those countries, they've not fully destroyed the legal system or achieved the levels of militarization and violence of fascism. What has stopped them, or at least so far?
Well, it's different, you know, these are different cases. In the case of Hungary, I think, you know, a key element is that as much as he criticizes the European Union, he, you know, Hungary is still within the European Union, and he will not or at least he has not been willing to do what he seems to be also aspiring to, which is totally destroy democracy. He has downgraded it and bastardized it, but did not destroy it. But this different, I was saying, like the four pillars of fascism and how the wannabe fascists approach them in different ways. Like in terms of violence, probably Modi is one of the most extreme, forms of wannabe fascist violence. This is a regime that engaged in actual pogroms against ethnic minorities, something that we have not seen in other places. You know, the rule of Duterte in the Philippines also was incredibly violent. So in terms of that pillar of fascism, way more radical than others. Now, in the US, what you see is like a stress on the four, and a particularity of its own. But my point is, like, despite their differences, despite stressing one or the other elements, what we are seeing is not the typical populism, but a form of populism that is flying very close to fascism.
Well, one thing that's been argued when the United States has been compared to other countries is that, you know, for all its problems, the U.S. has a stronger institutional and democratic framework than, say, Hungary, that the underpinnings of the legal system is more robust. Would you say that the U.S. is all that different?
In many ways, I think it's worse. I mean, you wonder to what extent we have separation of power in the U.S. So at the judicial level, we have a Supreme Court that so far has been like, you know, a sidekick of the president. And we have a majority in Congress that is not even doing, you know, the job they are supposed to do and deferring to the president, you know, in every single moment. So basically, I think, you know, the U.S. is in, you know, is in a, I think it's in a very problematic context.
From the start of Trump's second term, and I think to the surprise of many, including those who would say, well, the United States has these robust traditions of democracy, etc., we've seen mainstream and liberal institutions, such as powerful law firms and universities and the mainstream media, cave in front of the administration. Did that surprise you? And if not, why not?
It doesn't surprise me because historically we have seen like previous situations where many people did not realize that rather than accommodating, they were kind of self-suppressing and even, you know, self-destroying. That this is like a, you know, that this is not a give and take, but rather a kind of very very ambitious project of domination. And in that sense, it's a mistake to normalize what are like clear acts against democracy. Regarding, you know, going back to your previous question, is that, you know, this kind of almost a fantasy or a faith that institutions, you know, will be enough to defend U.S. democracy from being destroyed from within. I mean, well, there was an attempt at a coup d'etat, and you know, and as we can see it now, the institutions did not prevail, even to the extent that people that were that faced the law were given an amnesty after Trump came to power in his second presidency.
Continuing that vein, you know, of those sectors of society who might push back in some way or inhibit Trump, putting the billionaire supporters of Trump aside, there has been speculation about the business class as a whole and how it regards the Trump policies. Obviously, you know, at this point, Trump seems sort of riding high. Do you also think that it would be mistaken to think that at some point this class might come around to a negative view of Trump and to the point that they would be an impediment in any way, especially if the Trump administration moved toward more fascist policies, which might undermine the stability of profit-making?
I think that is a great point, and I agree with the question and the possible answer. I'm an historian, so I'm an expert on the past. I don't know what would happen, but history tells us that, you know, fascism and wannabe fascism too, it has, since it's rooted in the denial of reality, at some point it becomes self-destructive, and it leads to disaster, and it leads to crisis, and the inability insofar as reality is denied, to solve problems, you know, coming from that reality into the ideological bubble of the leader. But sometimes it takes a lot of time and a lot of people suffer the consequences. But, you know, supporters too suffer the consequences of that, of those disastrous politics based on violence, demonization and hatred, and of course, a kind of constant attack against the rule of law. Eventually that leads to crisis. Eventually in the past it led to self-destruction. But that could take time, and you know, and a lot of people will suffer.
When one's thinking about fascism and the way, the form it takes, what would it take to unify the state and civil society in the way that is seen under fascism? What would that look like in a society like this?
Well, I mean, the point is that for the people, I mean, there are some people that, you know, they care about pluralism and they care about rights. And those are the first to understand how problematic what we are seeing is, you know, with respect to the future of democracy in this country and in the world. Now, there are others that it will take more time in order for them to realize how problematic this is. I mean, a kind of cult of the leader, which is based on extreme hierarchical views of society, often leads to, or, you know, ideologically leads to, you know, fewer opportunities for the many and more opportunities for the few. And eventually, politically even, that is problematic for these kind of leaders. So, I mean, I think, you know, this you know, when fascism failed, it failed not only because of the strength of institutions, but also because people were increasingly willing to defend those institutions and act against what sooner or later they saw as incredibly unequal elements in those proposals. So I think it's very important to defend those rights and you know, and you know, and argue and protest and vote and try to convince others that this is the case.
Well, speaking from the experience of South America, where you come from, can you speak concretely to the ways that people have organized against right-wing authoritarian governments, and if there are particular lessons beyond what you've just mentioned to be gleaned from those experiences, including the dirty war of the generals in Argentina?
Yes, I mean, I'm from Argentina and I was born like in 1975, and sooner, you know, we had a coup d'etat and I lived the first decade of my life under dictatorship. And that dictatorship, which was also pretty close to fascism, I wrote a book about this, which is called The Ideological Origins of the Dirty War. That dictatorship was very close to fascism, and also, and it wanted like to somehow solve what, you know, an economic and political crisis by way of extreme violence, propaganda, and eventually even external war. On the economic side, you know, it had politics which were very similar to the ones that, you know, President Trump has, this idea of somehow solidifying the income of the few in order to somehow affirm that eventually that would lead to other people being you know, affected by it, this cascade effect that historically is very dubious. And eventually that dictatorship ended, you know, in economic crisis, in political crisis, and with a lost war. And democracy came, and when democracy came, nobody wanted to remember how many people supported that dictatorship. There was a lot of suffering, and eventually, you know, they sort of failed, and you know, and people that had supported them now were supporting democracy. Others, of course, had supported democracy, you know, even under dictatorship. But I think it was important at that time, you know, two things. One was that in Argentina there was such link between history and justice that people that were, you know, people were put on trial for their corrupt, you know, violent crimes against Argentine citizens. And on the other hand, I mean, for the rest of the country, you know, it didn't matter much what the different people had believed before, but the fact that now they believe, you know, in the power of democracy to do politics, and I think that became the political culture of the country, and I guess the lessons, the horrible lessons of the past, were learned. Now, I might also say that in Argentina now we have a kind of, you know, young Padawan of sorts, a mini Trumpist of sorts, which is Javier Milei, who has, he basically broke with that political culture of, you know, of denouncing dictatorship, and even now he kind of resurrects some of the propaganda of that dictatorship. So also in Argentina we are seeing the return of something that was, you know, more rooted in the fascist past than in the, you know, in the democratic present, but now that is also coming back.
Well, along with the question of thinking, which you spoke about earlier, the concern now that we're seeing a right-wing authoritarianism in the United States that could align into fascism. You mentioned earlier four pillars of fascism, four elements that are definitive of fascism, political violence being one, myth and propaganda and misinformation being another, xenophobia, but then ultimately also dictatorship. You write that not all dictatorships are fascist, but there is no fascism without dictatorship. Now, clearly in the United States, we don't have dictatorship, not at this point anyway. I wanted to ask you about the other ones. The question of political violence, obviously great violence is being played out in cities and rural areas around the country as ICE swoops down and abducts people. At the same time, those who study ostensibly political, so that's obviously coming from the state itself, but those who study political violence and track it say that, I guess what we'd call paramilitary violence or political violence on the right that doesn't come directly from the state is actually at a bit of a low right now, you know, perhaps because so much violence is coming from the state, right wing militia groups, for example. How do you see political violence in this moment? How would you understand where we're at this point?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, your point is super well taken, that is, you know, that there might be a correlation between state violence and paramilitary violence. And, you know, traditionally, most ideologies are sort of aligned with the theory of Max Weber, who said that the monopoly of violence makes for a powerful state. But that state is powerful when that monopoly of violence means that violence will not be unleashed. And thereby, a weak state is the state that constantly needs to execute violence. Now, fascists, on the other hand, believe that the monopoly of violence is important, but also, what is also important is unleashing that violence. They believe this for reasons that relate to ideas of, you know, politics, war, manhood, and so on and so forth. And what we are seeing now, I mean, is extremely problematic, because, I mean, you were before, you asked me about my country and you know, the quote-unquote dirty war that the dictatorship unleashed on its citizens, in which different, you know, agents of the state will be like arresting people like in unmarked cars, you know, and they will not identify themselves nor be identifiable, and so on and so forth. So as an Argentine, for me, when I see, you know, people that claim to be agents of the state, you know, mask with unmarked cars and arresting people, I wonder, I mean, are these truly agents of the state? How do I know that? I mean, this is like in my view, this is a kind of it's true that we are not living under dictatorship, but this is a dictatorial move. I mean, these kind of things that we are seeing happen more under dictatorship than in you know, in true constitutional democracies. And what we are seeing also is, like, you know, lack of qualifications. Who are these people? And why should I believe that these are agents of the state? I have no clue, personally. And this is like more typical of dictatorial regimes.
You were also saying that what you call the wannabe fascists, although all politicians lie, all politicians say untruths, that there, it's sort of a qualitatively different kind of misinformation and propaganda. How do you see that with the Trump administration? Because, of course, we're seeing this very strange moment. I mean, it's not really a moment. It's been going on for much longer, but where there has been the intersection of right-wing ideology and propaganda with the technology of AI, which generates all sorts of stuff, some which is ostensibly political, some which is not, but can serve political purposes.
Well, I think, you know, what we are learning is, if for people that had doubts about it, I did not, is that the U.S. is extremely unprepared for a wannabe fascist. I mean, it's really unprepared to face them. It's really unprepared to, you know, to contest what are outrageously illegal acts. And for example, like the current administration has been bombing out, killing people like in the Caribbean, like without any kind of due process, of course. And you know, and this kind of violence, I mean, it's really, at the same time that it's shocking and outrageous, it's extremely normalized and nothing happens. This continues again and again and again. So I think, you know, the problem that we are living, like generally speaking, is not only that this politics is based on fantasies, lies, and the manipulation of you know, of facts, but also that, you know, it leads to actions that are completely normalized, and they shouldn't be.
Do you think one of the reasons why we're seeing the kind of steamrolling over U.S. society by the Trump administration also has something to do with the general weakness of the left? You were saying that you think the U.S. is particularly unprepared. And, you know, looking at economically advanced industrial countries, the U.S., at least in the latter half of the 20th century and into the 21st, is distinguished for not having as strong a left as some other countries. Does the weakness of the left make the society particularly vulnerable?
I think so. I mean, one of the paradoxes is, of course, that unlike other societies, there was in recent histories, like not dictatorship in the US. Of course, there was, you know, a lot of violence and racism. But I think, you know, sometimes the lack of a tradition of protest against authoritarian forms, dictatorial forms, doesn't convey the message that not everybody agrees with this. And yet we are seeing like a kind of relinking between the current protests about rights, the No King marches, for example, and you know, incredibly rich traditions of protest, you know, in the during the 20th century in the US. And I think that is important.
Let me just end by asking you about the midterm elections in the fall and the anxieties that I've certainly heard voiced, that particularly for those who are afraid that we're heading toward fascism, that all is lost, that there's sort of no pulling back. Is there a danger in people becoming sort of paralyzed in this moment? And do you think that that can have political ramifications for turning things around? And I guess really I'm also asking if you feel like elections are enough to turn things around.
Well, I mean, elections matter and they are extremely important. And you know, when we are not living, this is a kind of when I talk about wannabe fascism, I present it as a kind of incomplete process, which is not only up to the wannabe dictators to finish, but also to the rest of us, in the sense that, you know, it's important to convey ways in which people disagree with this and they agree more with equality, plurality, and democracy. And in that sense, elections are important in the same way as, reading important sources of information and not only fantasies and propaganda, protesting and defending, you know, the freedom of the press and the rule of law.
Federico Finkelstein, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Sasha.
Federico Finkelstein is University in Exile research professor, at the New School in New York. He's an expert on populism, fascism, and dictatorship, author most recently of The Wannabe Fascists, A Guide to Understanding the Greatest Threat to Democracy. He's also the author of A Brief History of Fascist Lies and From Fascism to Populism in History. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.